Barnett said, I wrote another letter and said, no, we want to keep you. But it was funny because his perception of the evaluation and what the receiver were two different things, you know.
Was it unusual for them at
University of Pennsylvania
to have military residents? Must have been.
Well, in pediatrics, I was the only one they had up to that time, and maybe ever since. There might have been a few in other specialties, because the military was sending people to various big hospitals around the country to get special training of one kind or another, and for all I know, in today's world, they never would have let me go to a civilian hospital, because in 1961, I guess, they started their own Air Force residencies, and I may have been told, we're sorry, you're going to go take one of ours.
Yeah, you had no choice.
I had a choice. I don't know whether I'd have had a choice later. I just don't know. But anyway...
later, you might not have.
Right. Then I remembered my brother, Bob, who had been in the Navy in the Second World War, you know, used to use the famous military, keep your mouth shut and your bowels open, and never volunteer for anything. That was the three rules. Keep your mouth shut, your bowels open, and never volunteer. So
the military is a whole new world.
Oh, it was. Well, I'm going to tell you I'm going to tell you how I learned some of this. February or so of that year, I get the letter from Wright-Patterson, and it says, you're due to finish your residency in July. Yes, or June. You will be assigned, and you have a 5-year obligation to the Air Force. Please indicate on the letter whether you would like to go and be assigned to the Eastern United States, the Central United States, the Western United States, European or Asia, which was Japan, or Africa, Turkey, and a few other places. And I hadn't the slightest idea about what all this was about. And so my brother's advice stuck, and I remember calling up this office that it came from. Actually, it was in the Pentagon, outside the Pentagon, but in Washington, D.C. I called and I talked to some sergeant, and I say, "This, Dr. Scully, I'm finishing my resume." "Oh, yeah, we have you on the list." "I haven't the slightest idea about military life. Yes, I interned in an Army hospital. I don't know what to put down. And what I'd like to do, if I could, is take a train down, come and talk to somebody about my career." Because there was, as you point out, there was no Air Force liaison officer at the University of Pennsylvania. There was nobody to talk to.
Sure.
I think there was an Army ROTC guy, but I may even gone and talked to him.
I'm sure he knew less than you did.
So he said, "Oh, sure, come on down anytime. Just give us a call and let us know you're coming." So I went to Dr. Barnett and said, "I'd like to take a Friday off, if I may. Take the train down, middle of winter." So I did. Took the train first thing in the morning. Was maybe a 2-hour drive to Washington, D.C. And I got a cab and went over to this place. And by the time I got there, it was noon. And I walked in, and there wasn't a soul in the place except one sergeant. So he said, "Well, I can't help you, doctor. They're all out to lunch. But Captain so-and-so and Sergeant so-and-so who do this will be back about 1:30.
Did you wear your uniform?
Oh gosh, yes, I was in uniform. Oh, definitely. I didn't make that mistake. Yeah. I was in uniform. So I said, "Well, do you want to go have lunch with me?" So he said, "Yeah." So I took this sergeant out to lunch. I went to some place and I said, "Would you like a drink?" And he said, "Oh, sure." So I bought him a drink. I didn't have it. Might have had a beer. Bought him a martini, and he said, "Do you want another one?" "Sure." So I bought him lunch, and he had a couple of drinks. We came back to the office at about 2 o'clock. He introduced me to the captain, and the captain and the sergeant sat down and said, "Well, tell us about yourself." And I said, "I don't know even what's available. I think, since I've got a 5-year commitment, I'd like to go overseas for a couple of years and then come back." And they said, "Well, we need a pediatrician in Madrid. We need a pediatrician in Wheelis, which is in Libya. We need a pediatrician in Turkey, in Izmir, Turkey, I guess. We also need a pediatrician in Tachihara, whatever it's called, in Japan." And I said, "Oh, I'd like to go to Spain."
Sure.
And he said, well, why? And I said, well, my wife is fluent. Her mother was raised there. She has aunts and uncles and cousins. My wife has visited Spain several times. Matter of fact, she was on one of the first planes that was flew into Madrid after the Civil War, or the Second World War was over. Because the Civil War ended in 1939, the Second World War began, so Spain was literally closed for almost 10 years. Mm-hmm. From the beginning of the Civil War in 1936 to the end of the Second World War in 1945, 9 years. And Celia and her mother went back on one of the first TWA flights into Madrid right after the war was over. And Madrid and Toledo and those places looked like they did in during the Civil War, still gone pockmarked. But anyway, at that time, Eisenhower had just finished, Kennedy, of course, was president now, but Eisenhower had been the president and opened up the base there in Madrid in 1958. But there was a lot of concern because of a lot of anti-Franco feeling. Franco was still a dictator, that they didn't want ugly Americans there. And so they, we think part of it was, well, my wife had Spanish relatives there and could speak the language. I don't think that probably had anything to do with anything. I think what really was the influence that I took the guy to lunch and bought him a couple of drinks. So after we talked about this, my preference would be go first to Madrid, and then I gave him a few other choices.
Now this was the sergeant?
Yeah, sergeant.
You took to lunch?
Yeah.
So he had something to do with your
placement. So he said, well, we can't promise you a thing, Doc, but thanks for coming to see us. So about 2 weeks later, I get a letter. You have been assigned to Madrid.
Great.
Absolutely. No, I know absolutely it was the visit.
Yeah.
I know it was taking him to lunch. And
the martinis didn't hurt.
I don't know. I won't even say that. And I wouldn't remember the man's name, and I don't want to impugn anybody's reputation. And maybe he didn't have martinis, maybe he had a beer. But anyway, we chatted, and he was very nice. He was a guy with I don't know how many stripes. And that's when I realized that the sergeants ran the military. And I also realized that they had slots, and they didn't have computers. He had a card file in those days. There was no computer that I remember, 1960, 1961. He just went through there, and he had to fill a slot, and here's a guy that showed enough interest to come down for the day, and it was pleasant, and so we get assigned.
He wasn't an ugly American.
Always wonderful.
That was important.
Yeah, probably was. I don't really know.
I think it was.
But anyway, I get assigned. But let me finish that story, and then we'll come back to Madrid.
Okay.
3 years later, I have 3 years to go. And the military was very nice. After you had been in for the first two years, and if you were eligible to take your specialty board exams, they would ship you back to the United States at the expense of the military to take your exam. So I was ready to take my pediatric boards in December of 1963 now, 2 years later. So I purposely asked to have them taken at the Children's Hospital in Washington, D.C. So I flew back to Washington from Madrid, I don't know, through Newfoundland or someplace, and spent a few days studying. Then I went and took my exam. It was over. On the day it was over, I went over to that same building, and the same sergeant is sitting there.
Oh, my word.
And I said, Sergeant so-and-so, how are you? And he said, oh, Doc, it's nice to see you. How have you enjoyed Spain? I said, oh,
I
really enjoyed it very much. As you know, I've got 2 more years in obligated service, maybe longer. I may make it a career. I didn't say I wouldn't. And I'm coming back to the United States. I'd like to... he said, well, you know the way it is. I can't promise you a thing, Doc, but... I said, well, let's go have lunch. So I invited him out to lunch. We went out and had lunch. I don't know what he had, a martini or beer or whatever. Maybe he didn't have anything. We came back. And he said, well, let's see, in July we need people here, 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 and here. And I said, well, I'd love to go to the Air Force Academy. He said, well, sorry, that's one place you can't go. I said, why? He said, well, Curtis LeMay's son-in-law is a pediatrician, and he's assigned there. And Curtis LeMay was the chief of staff of the Air Force at the time. So I said, well, I would like to get involved in education. I'd like to try my hand. Do you have any places that have residencies? And Lackland had just opened the previous year, or maybe it was the first year. And he said, well, I don't know. Well, let's look into that. I'll look into that, but have a good trip back home. So about a month later, I get a letter saying, you've been assigned to Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio in the Department of Pediatrics. But what gave me the clue that the guys in Washington were running the show is a few weeks after that, I get a letter from the chief of pediatrics at Lackland saying, dear Dr. Scully, or Captain Scully, I've forgotten which, welcome, we're glad you'll be coming to Lackland. I must say I was surprised because I didn't realize we were going to be getting an extra position this year.
Oh my word. This fellow wielded some power.
Well, he was the guy.
The military.
He was the guy that had the cards and had to decide. And I'm sure he didn't do it on his own. I'm sure he talked to some captain and they talked to some colonel. And they're sitting in Washington. They haven't talked to anybody. Mm-hmm. All of its correspondence. They don't know who all these people are. And someone. So I remember my brother's admonition: don't volunteer for anything. And I also, my own instinct was I ought to talk to somebody because I didn't have the slightest idea. What was going to, so anyway, that's getting a little bit ahead of Spain, but that was the tail end of how I, after my 3 years in Madrid. We can go back and talk about Madrid.
So you were starting to think about, think about education at this point.
Yes, I was. And actually I was thinking maybe that since the Lackland had opened, and I know they were going to open up Andrews Air Force Base in Washington, they were eventually going to start a program at Travis Air Force Base here in, outside of Sacramento.
Fairfield.
I thought, well, I might make a career out of the Air Force and stay in one of their teaching hospitals and become a teaching pediatrician in the Air Force. I knew by the time I got out, I already would have 10 to 11 years in. Heck, I only had to stay another 8 or 10 years, or 10 years or 11 before I could retire. So I hadn't ruled out making it a career.
I see. Well, that was going to be my question.
I had not ruled it out.
If you were ever thinking about it.
I was thinking about it only, and I was beginning to think about it in the context of getting involved and being at a teaching hospital. And
were you sort of thinking at that point that you didn't want to go into a private practice? When did that start, do you think?
Oh, that started.
Because you never had a private practice, did
no,
you?
No, I was always in. No, no.
Yeah,
I was,
you were always.
I was still in training. Oh, no.
I mean, in your career, it wasn't a private.
Oh, yes, I did in Las Vegas. So I came to Vegas
too.
Oh, yes,
okay.
And I'll tell you about that later.
All right.
That's when we got to Vegas, so we came to a private practice. And I'm glad I did that. In retrospect, I'll tell you why later. But, no, initially I saw, well, I might make the Air Force a career, especially if I can get assigned to teaching hospitals where there's interns and residents. But if not, I'll try my hand at private practice. I'll just see what happens.
The military life wasn't so bad then.
Oh gosh, no.
You got paid.
I have no regrets.
As an officer, you had decent housing.
No regrets. And most of the places that we lived on the economy anyway. I was renting a house in San Antonio. I was renting a house in Madrid. In Madrid we were on the base, sorry. I had no regrets, and we had a good life, and Celia was, I have absolutely nothing bad to say about the Air Force. I was well treated, I got good education, they got their pound of flesh out of me, I paid back every nickel, and it was mutually good for me, and I don't know if it was for them or not.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I come back from this experience in winter. It was a cold, rainy day in Philadelphia and Washington. I come back home and talk to Dr. Burness and say, well, I talked to the sergeant. I don't know where I'm going to go. A month or so later, we get the letter, and Celia and I are ecstatic. And it probably saved our marriage and her sanity that we were able to go to Madrid with three little children and get some help for practically nothing.
Sure.
Because, of course, and I feel embarrassed about it and even guilty. We've talked about it many times. I remember Celia and I talking to a local chaplain, a priest, a Catholic priest on the base about the poverty in Spain. I mean, poverty. When we arrived there, it was almost like it was during the Civil War. The garbage collection was still done. People would rummage through the garbage dumps that were open air, and they picked up garbage in open wagons pulled by donkeys. There were very few cars. Most of Celia's relatives who were middle class were eking by. There was, in the winter time, the heat would go off. They turned the heat off in February, no matter how cold it was, and they wouldn't turn it on again until the next November.
This was a fascist regime, wasn't it?
Yes, but it was also it was still a poverty-stricken country that was still recovering from the Civil War. And this was 12 years later, mm-hmm. from 39 to 61. Oh, 21 years later, 39, 49, 59, 60, 20 years later. Terrible poverty all over. And the village where a couple of the maids that worked for us came from, you'd walk there, the shacks were dirt floor. They'd sweep the dirt. They were hard dirt. And kids without shoes. And we had a lot of trouble with that, but at least we employed four people for practically nothing. And we would, against the rules, Celia would go not to the base. We never violated the rule at the base, but we'd go downtown, and Celia would buy powdered milk and buy all sorts of things just to see some of these kids fed. I went and made house calls in a couple of these villages and treated kids that obviously were sick as hell and gave me antibiotics and a bunch of stuff.
You mean as a military?
Oh, sure. On my
civilians?
Own. No, but on my own.
Oh, on your own.
And I'll tell you why in a minute.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was really very, very poor. But for $15 a month, $15 a month, and room and board, you could have a live-in maid. We did. Everybody did. Everybody had a chica. And the chicas didn't do any cleaning. They were not an asistenta. They were a chica. They would help cook, and they'd help take care of your kids.
Kind of like a nanny?
Yeah.
Au pair?
Yeah. And we had two or three of them because they would come, and they would learn a little English. They would, Celia bought the first pair of shoes for a couple of them, would buy them clothing, buy them underwear, give them feminine products, all sorts of stuff, you know, to bring them from a pueblo where they were living in poverty, mm-hmm. to be able to go out on Sunday and meet their friends on Paseo downtown Madrid. So we had a chica. We had three of them. Each one lasted about a year. One of them was wonderful and was there when Marty was born, because I delivered Marty at home in that house in Spain, Madrid. And then we had an asistenta, and the asistenta would come every day, and she'd do the cleaning and do the laundry. And then the asistenta's husband would come on Saturday and cut the kids' hair and wash my car. And on Sunday, he would come and cut my grass for a couple of bucks. And but everybody was the same. But that was the only cash, and it was American dollars they were getting.
Oh, sure.
And I remember talking about it with the priest. It was a problem for us, you know. But he also said, you know...
Why, did you feel you were exploiting them?
Well, there was some of that.
Or was it the sadness of what you were
It was
seeing?
The sadness of trying to relieve what you were seeing. But
the social
thousands, millions, well, hundreds of thousands, obviously.
Yeah.
That was the first issue. The second issue is, he said, if you are too generous and too open with your generosity to these small families, they may become ostracized within their own little community that they had to go home to every night. And so you want to be careful that you don't disturb their social environment. And that this is a structural thing that has to be corrected. Well, of course, Spain has done a lot better when Franco died and Juan Carlos took over, and the democratic government took over in the economy. And Eisenhower's bases agreement really was helpful in that sense. It did bring a lot of investment into Spain, because it was not only the base in Madrid, but there was a naval base in Rota, another air base in Morón, which is outside of Sevilla, and another air base in Zaragoza, which is in the north of Spain. So there were three big air bases, because remember, at that time the Cold War was on, and we were concerned about Russia, and there were nuclear bombs, I'm sure, all over the place. Also, because of that, place things like Pepsi-Cola and Coca-Cola, they invested in bottling plants there. I remember Squibb opened a drug company thing there. There were, so Madrid was beginning, we saw in the early 60s, because we got there in the summer of 1961, we were seeing changes that, and even Celia's family, you know, now we were not the typical American military living on the base and never going downtown. There were many, many military who would go to the officers' club and never wanted to, which is crazy. Madrid's a marvelous city. So we lived, although we lived on the Air Force base, we got downtown as much as often as we could, went out to dinner with all of her cousins and nephews and uncles and aunts, and they'd come to our house, and so, and she would speak Spanish with them. We took Spanish lessons to improve our Spanish. Mine was terrible, but hers was good. So we got very much involved in Madrid because it was Celia coming back to her mother's roots, sure, if you will. And at any rate, as I said earlier in this discussion, getting to Spain was wonderful because for the first time we took a vacation without kids. We had a chica that we could count on, and so we took our first trip to Rome. Never been to Rome, always wanted to go to Rome and see the Pope.
You left the kids.
Yeah, oh gosh, yes. Well, after she'd been with us for a number of months. Mm-hmm. And of course, we lived in a compound so that all when one military family would leave, there were always neighbors who would look in on your kids.
Other military,
of course.
Oh yeah, sure.
All the neighbors were military, and we made some very good friends. Some of our very best friends today were friends we made in Madrid.
Sort of the outskirts of Madrid.
Yeah, it was the outskirts. Uh-huh. And subsequently, because of those friendships, I ended up in Las Vegas. We'll get to later. But so we do the same when some of our friends were going to take a trip and go to Germany or go to London or wherever they wanted to go, because all of us had a few bucks now. The others would look in on the chica and be sure that the maid was watching the kids and they were dressed and all that sort of stuff.
Did you travel military or was it
civilian? No, all civilian. No,
you couldn't
take a military flight.
And so on.
Only on military business.
Yeah.
So we went to Rome for the first time. We went to Mallorca. We went to all over southern Spain. Matter of fact, with one of Celia's aunts and a cousin, we drove all over and it was wonderful because they were our tour guides. I drove the big American car. They didn't even own a car. I brought over the big American Ford that I had, and we would drive and go away for the weekend and leave the kids with a maid. So we had some free time.
The roads must have been
horrible.
Not so great.
They were terrible.
Yeah.
They were beginning to build the infrastructure. There were good roads around Madrid. They go out maybe 20 or 30 miles,
right, and that was
the end of it.
We were there just a year ago.
Well, sure.
The roads
and
were wonderful.
Yeah, but that's all been the last 30 years.
Yeah.
This is 1961 is what, almost 40 years ago.
Yeah, hard to believe.
Yeah, almost 40 years ago. So we, we got there. We got into our little house. We were allowed to bring a certain amount of furniture over, so we actually brought that piano that belonged to Celia because she played the piano. And we brought some furniture, although most of the furniture was a furnished place, so there was a washer and a dryer and all that stuff. So we took a few minor things, very little. Most of our furniture that we had in Albany, El Paso, and Philadelphia, we stored in Philadelphia till we came back 3 years later. And the military paid for the storage, which was nice. But we did ship our car over, so I had a nice Ford Fairlane and four-door, and we could travel around. And so it was again an important part of our life as a couple and as a family, because then Marty was conceived and born there. I delivered him at home one night. Marty was the number four son. And of course Leslie was conceived there and born just after we got back to San Antonio.
And
several
Leslie's
years later.
Your daughter.
She's the daughter, yeah.
And Marty was
born in 62, Gary in 60, Marty in 62, and Leslie in 64, just after we got back. So I would say, and Celia would agree with me, that 3 years in Spain was probably the most important period of our married life.
Well, you had it pretty rough up until then, because no matter how adaptable you were to the to medical life, you were away a lot, and a lot fell on her.
Yep. Oh, absolutely.
Three babies.
Absolutely.
Two babies.
Yep. So it was, and she was, she then was the center of attention of a lot of her friends. When they were having trouble with their maids, they'd call Celia Rover or come over, and Celia would help figure out what was going on, because they weren't understanding the nuances of why she didn't come to work for them that day, or what her boyfriend was into, or
she
all that sort of
language.
Stuff. And then when we often would go out with friends downtown, American friends, you know, she could help them with the menu, and she could help them with all that. So
so you were accepted fairly well by the...
Oh, gosh, yes.
The Spanish people.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm sure it's the case in many foreign countries. If you can speak the language, that's one help. But if you even make an attempt to communicate in their language, it's appreciated.
You didn't see, feel hostility anywhere?
None. No, but we were given a set of rules when we got there about being ugly Americans. For example, we never wore our uniforms down off
the
base.
That was my question. You
never.
Did not.
You did not. The only time you wore your uniform was to and from work and at work. So there were times when you'd go through, because from where we lived, we had to go through a couple of villages before we could get the base. So there was some, I mean, you'd stop, you know, to get some gas or something, but you never would go and prance downtown Madrid.
In your uniform.
In a uniform, never. That was verboten. Mm. And even the generals and the big shots at the embassy all wore civilian clothes. I mean, this was Franco's country, and it was, as a matter of fact, most people don't know this, but at Torrejon Air Force Base and the other bases I mentioned, there was no American flag. The Spanish flag flew at the front gate, and Spanish soldiers ushered you in.
Oh, so?
But you had your thing, you had your plate on your car, and you had an identification, and you showed it to them, so they knew. And once you were on the base, the whole thing was run by the Americans.
So you were there as the guest of Franco.
You were there as the guest of Franco. And at the hospital, which was an excellent hospital, half the physicians were Spanish nationals. Several Spanish military, but most of them were civilian Spanish doctors. So all of us, there were maybe, I think, 18 or 20 American physicians, I've forgotten the exact number, and another 10 or 15 Spanish physicians, and we were colleagues. There was only one other pediatrician. He was a Spanish national, married to an American nurse that he met at the Children's Hospital in Washington, D.C. when he came to the United States to do his residency. And they had four or five children. We see them all. We talk to them, and we write them, and we visited many times back and forth in the last 30 years.
Spanish medical training was
Good? Spanish medical school was okay, but very little of what we would call hospital residency training. Mm-hmm. Most of the Spanish physicians would leave the country, go to the United States, England, or Germany, where they would get more practical and more up-to-date modern medicine. So everyone but one, I think, well, I'll say almost every one of the Spanish physicians had come to the United States, maybe one to England, and trained in our way of, and then they came back and were hired by the American government to work in this hospital, and they, because many of the American soldiers were married to Spanish girls and had Spanish American kids, and we also took care of a lot of the Spanish military who were assigned to that base. So the Spanish physicians were, they all spoke fluent English. We didn't speak fluent Spanish, of course. So they were there also to meet the needs of the Spanish-speaking military dependents and the Spanish military. But you went through the gate, there was no American flag. Sure, there was American flags inside the hospital and in a few places on the base. And, of course, the flight line where all the bombers and the jets were, that was all controlled by the American military.
And you wore uniforms on the base, all of you.
And so did the Spanish officers.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. The Spanish civilian doctors didn't, you know, they just wore their civilian clothes.
But you didn't have that there again. It was strictly military people taking care of military people.
Oh, yes.
Plus the Spanish civilians.
That's correct. That's correct.
The Spanish civilians married to American military you're talking about?
No. Sorry.
No, I mean the ones you took care of.
The ones we took care of would be American military married to Spanish girls. Mostly
right.
Men.
And you would take care of the dependents.
And the dependents. Absolutely. Because right. They were
but
entitled
no
to care.
But no civilians from the
town? No, absolutely not. No.
Except the little
none.
Extracurricular activity.
Well,
you
yeah.
About.
And I did that occasionally with my Spanish colleague, Lucas Dr. Rubio, who just wonderful. Wonderful physician, still is terrific.
Did you know
guy.
Juan Nunez?
No. Well, I knew him here, but I didn't
here
know.
You met him
yeah.
here. I don't know where he's from, but I think Barcelona, mm-hmm. not.
No, well, yeah, I think so. Lucas would say, "I'm going to go out and see some patients in a little village. You want to go with me?" So you know, we'd go.
Oh.
And anyway, that was where we practiced medicine. We went every day. We had an inpatient service. Medicine, pediatrics, OB, delivered a lot of babies there. I didn't, but I did pediatric. So there was myself and one other pediatrician, a Spanish national who was American trained, spoke fluent English, and we took care of all the kids who came in, sick. We took care of the babies in the nursery. And
what
was
the
health
of the children of the Spanish women?
Oh, it's good. I mean,
they
yeah.
would treat their children, because
oh,
they
yes.
had money coming in, they could feed their children
sure,
well.
Sure, sure. And, you know, there was always some discussion about these young girls from the Pueblos, you know, who would latch onto a young American in hopes they get out of the country and go to the United States, and who knows what happened to subsequently. Their health was okay. And,
no tuberculosis?
No, didn't see any of that. If anything, you know, I'm sure there were some who weren't well nourished, but basically the dependence of the American serviceman got immunizations and was brought to the clinic like anybody else, and they got their food from the commissary and from the PX.
So there was no restriction in their minds that they didn't maybe have these immunizations, so they wouldn't give them to their children.
Oh gosh, no.
The
no,
children
no.
were immunized.
Well cared for, just like any other American kid. They were American citizens. Their father was an American Air Force man.
Sure. But if they were raised that way, you know, I wondered about the mentality of raising their children. You didn't see any of that.
No. But you see, I was seeing a small microcosm of Spain through the eyes of Americans
mm-hmm.
when it came to the base. Now, but
yeah.
I saw Spain through the eyes of Celia's family as far as the social and the cultural and the historical, but I'm talking about the way I practiced medicine. It wasn't much different than practicing in any other military hospital. I took care of whoever came.
Sure.
And
but when you went out into the community, what did you see?
Poverty. Lots of poverty in many of those pueblos. And many of the pueblos where the chicas would come and work on the base lived in those villages.
And what did the children you took care of, what did they have? What diseases?
Oh, God, I remember one time there were a whole bunch of kids and families who got shigellosis, which is dysentery, from contaminated water, a water well, and they were getting their water out of this well in the center of the village, and it was contaminated. And Lucas and I took care of, we must have started IVs on 50 or 60 kids. They were just shrunken prunes, dried up from diarrhea.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that any of them died.
No, dehydrated is one.
Yeah, they were dehydrated, and of course we treated them. And
antibiotics, you...
Well, yeah, you don't really have to use antibiotics in some of those dysenteries, but the main thing is to get them hydrated. And I saw, I saw a number of fascinating diseases. I was asked to go to Lisbon, because there was a small outbreak there of diphtheria, and I also, for the only place I ever saw diphtheria, and I saw a number of other diseases from North Africa, because the Peace Corps volunteers who were in Africa when any of their kids would get sick, they would be air evacuated out of Africa to Madrid, or some would go to Wheelis. Most of them would come to Madrid. So we saw a lot of dependents of Peace Corps.
And where was Wheelis?
Wheelis was in Libya.
Oh.
Libya. I think that's, I'll have to check that. I think that's where it was. And so I saw unusual diseases, and I'll have to spell them later when we see the transcript. Leishmaniasis, Kala-Azar. I saw several children with echinococcus cyst, which is a type of parasitic worm that that you get from sheep. And I saw brucellosis. The only time I ever saw brucellosis, which you get from contaminated milk. So I
who,
saw
who
an,
was
and
taking
a
care
number
of these kids. I mean, did they have medical?
Well,
you and your friend were there as humanitarians, but normally who would be there taking care of these
well,
kids?
No, a lot of these would actually come to the Air Force Hospital because they were dependents of military in Africa. They were dependents of
Or they were. But when you went out to the little communities,
a couple of times.
You for medical care?
They didn't. They might have gone to the local emergency room, and they had a lot of what we would call sort of assistance, a physician assistant or something. And there wasn't medical care for a lot of those kids. A lot of them died. But that was a small part of what I'm saying. We did that a handful of times. But the diseases I was mentioning earlier that came out of Africa that I'd never seen before were in children, malaria, brucellosis, Kala-Azar, Leishmaniasis, all that stuff, even diphtheria. Those were diseases that American dependents of military in Africa, a lot of Peace Corps in Africa, and also the embassies. Remember, a lot of those African countries, there would be Americans there in the embassy. They may have not had much medical care, and one of the kids got sick, and no one knew what the hell was going on. They'd fly the kid up to the closest military base. Well, the closest big hospital to North Africa was Madrid. So people would be flown in with a variety of things that I never saw. And most of the time, I have to be honest, I didn't make the diagnosis. Lucas made the diagnosis because he was familiar with tropical medicine. I'd never seen any of them. I read about them.
Infectious diseases,
sure. I read about them and passed exams in them, you know, in pathology or microbiology. Mm-hmm. I never saw them. So saw some fascinating diseases. The only case of scurvy I ever saw was a kid whose the parents lived, they were military dependents, poor, you know, privates. They lived on one of the mountaintops where they had radar stations, and the mother had not gotten much help for her child and inappropriately boiled the milk that she gave her baby, and of course that destroys all the vitamin C. And this kid came in with classic scurvy, had no vitamin C. All the kid was eating was boiled milk.
Rickets, too?
I saw rickets as well. What most people don't know, at the time, there were radar sites, they used to be called, all over Western Europe. And they'd be on the top of mountains. And there'd be a little village there. And there might be 8 or 10 or 15 Air Force airmen, probably not even an officer, maybe a sergeant, and they'd have their wives, many of them might be Spanish nationals, and they lived on the economy in this little village, and they manned these radar sites or these beacons that the planes would use. Remember, military planes flying around the world in those days didn't have all the technology they have today, and they didn't have satellites telling them where to go. So they had to fly by radio beams, and they had, you know, all that sort of stuff. So a lot of these radar sites, I visited a number of them, and some of these episodes of going to the village that I've talked about occurred there where I went. And I remember one time there was a radar site in Mallorca, three or four of them actually, in the islands out in the water, and they had them on the top of mountains so that the planes could, see their way clear to go to Russia or wherever they're going to fly. And there they had an independent duty corpsman, because there were a fair number of people there. They used to be called corpsmen. And he called me on the phone and described what was going on. I said, sounds like the kid's got meningitis. I'll be there as soon as I can get an airplane. Start some antibiotics. So I called my neighbor, Dom Thompson, who was the chief of operations down at the flight line, and said, and I also called Lloyd Pickering, who was the flight surgeon. I said, this kid's going to be dead if we don't get him over here. So he said, fine, I'll get a plane, a jet, and we'll go. So I remember going down the flight line. It's been written up in one of the Air Force magazines. Down the flight line, they put me on a jet with Lloyd Pickering and a pilot and a co-pilot, flew us over to Mallorca. We picked up the kid. I did a spinal tap on the runway in the plane before they took off, and I started an IV before we got on the plane and started giving the antibiotics. The kid survived. Infant, 9, 10, 11 months old, something like that. And so I can recall some, those are all sort of dramatic things, but the average daily stuff was taken care of.
Quite an education.
Oh yeah, for me it was, yeah. It really was. And I've always been grateful to Lucas, because he taught me a lot of medicine or pediatrics that I never knew. The other thing I appreciate about going there was, it was just me and him doing pediatrics. Sure, there were other physicians who were very helpful, but I was leaving a very sheltered cocoon at the University of Pennsylvania, where you had consultants for everything, and although you could certainly get into trouble, there was plenty of people around to ask for advice, mm-hmm. and all of a sudden you're now responsible, and the closest people is by a telephone in Wiesbaden. That was the next biggest Air Force base. And where they had a hospital, so you had to be a little bit more independent, and you had an opportunity to practice your skills and your knowledge.
And you'd be treating the whole there, the whole patient. Rather than.
And I was there. This story we tell in our book in the early part of Playing God. I was one of the first physicians there to see born a baby, a product of thalidomide, with no arms. She was born at that hospital, and her mother had taken thalidomide as an anti-nausea, anti-morning sickness pill when she was on a vacation in Germany. And you could get pills like that in Germany. You couldn't in the United States at the time, but you could in Germany and France, I guess even in England, just over the counter. That the drug had not been released in this country, and there eventually were some 8,000 babies born without arms or legs or various other deformities, mostly arms and legs.
But at that time, were the effects of thalidomide known?
No. This was one of the first.
What did you think when this baby was born?
A statistical accident of some...
You didn't make the connection with...
There was no connection with thalidomide. It hadn't been published yet.
I see. It wasn't until later that you made the connection to why that baby was born that way.
I didn't. I wrote Lou Barnes the next week, and I said, there's been a baby born that I'm taking care of who has no arms. Uh-huh. I've never seen anything like it, never heard of it. Can you tell me what happened? So he wrote back and said, well, it... he looked it up in some of the books on malformations, and he and I joked about it since that time. Not about the kid, but about the circumstance.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, it's probably a 1 in 50,000 chance, and these things are not understood, and some accident took place. Well, not more than a couple of weeks after I get the letter back from him, the father walks into my office. The baby is now about 5 months old. And he opens up Time magazine, puts it on my desk, and tears running down his face. And there is a picture of a so-called flipper child who had no arms. And the story about the Lancet publishing the previous week that some epidemiologists in England had tied it to this drug.
Oh.
And he pulls out of his pocket a vial of... thalidomide, which was the trade name was Softenone in Germany, pulls out a vial, and he said, "We got these when we were in Germany last year when my wife was pregnant, and there were 10 in the bottle. She took two mornings in a row, and there were 8 still left. She found them.
Only 2
continued to go. Oh, yeah, it's all it took. If you took them very, very close together at about, and I could have to look up the details, it was around the 40th day of gestation. So it was just not even 6 weeks. Most women didn't even know they were pregnant because the arm buds come out in the developing fetus at about 38 to 40 some odd days. It's around 40 days of conception. So that's before 6 weeks, or it's around 6 weeks. So many women are just don't even know or just begin to know that they're pregnant. They've got morning sickness.
Sure.
This pill was being touted in Europe. It was not released in this country. Matter of fact, the lady at the FDA who prevented its release because she said there wasn't adequate safety testing having done on animals won the president's award from, I think, Kennedy. Somebody gave her an award because she was proven to be a hero at the time. She was being criticized for holding up this drug. At any rate, that's another story. But he came in with tears in his eyes. I took care of the child for the next year and a half or so before he came home to this country. We took her to Germany, and she got into the Heidelberg University program for prostheses along with lots of others. But there were about 8,000 kids. But anyway, he was in my office, tears in his eyes, shows me. So, I mean, we just hugged, we cried, I didn't know, that's all we did. And there was 2 pills. So shortly thereafter, I ran up to the library.